What's up, Wing Wing Nation? This is Joe here. We are cooking up a national tour, but we need some info from you. So if you click the link below, there's a survey. We need to know which cities to go to. If you want us to go to your hometown, let us know in the survey below and we will consider it. It takes like 30 seconds and you get 10% off our online store if you complete it. And come see us live in person. We're going to have car meets. We're going to have contests. We're going to have sim racing. It's going to be so fun. So let us know where to go. Get 10% off merch and it's a win-win. And let's get into the show.
Hey, what's up? Welcome back to the show, everybody. It is Jim Hall and the story of Chaparral this week. If you're a millennial and you played Gran Turismo 4, you probably drove a couple of Jim's cars back in the day on the old PS2. And guess what? It's almost time for your colonoscopy, too. It's just getting there. Anyway, this guy's story is really inspiring. He went through some pretty big tragedy earlier on in his life, but was able to carry on and become one of the most accomplished American racing drivers and designers of all time. So really cool episode. Let's get right into it. On November 10th, 1968, Jim Hall's Chaparral 2G was burning. He had just ramped off of McLaren, soared 20 feet in the air at Stardust International Raceway in Las Vegas, and nosedived into the ground, jarring the driver forward and back as 100 miles an hour turned into zero in an instant. When Hall looked down, he saw a foot in his lap. "That's my foot," he realized, still connected to his leg, but twisted around the steering column.
"That's my girlfriend's foot," he thought, and started massaging it.
"I thought, well, maybe I can shove it around the steering column and still get out of here." The pain of trying to wrench himself made Hall pass out, but his car was still on fire. It was a damn good thing his crash had taken place just across from the pit lane, because somehow, a handful of people were able to drag the Texan out of the pile of crumpled bodywork and throw dirt on him until the fire went out. If Jim Hall had died that day, motorsport would have looked a whole lot different. No ground effect cars, no driver-controlled wings, no automatic transmissions in race cars. But he didn't. He lived, and his innovations helped shape modern motorsport. How did a quiet kid from Texas learn how to race? How did Hall manage to survive his Stardust crash, and then survive an even worse injury just a few months later? And just how many times did Jim Hall change motorsport history? Today on Pass Gas, we're going to find out. It's Jim Hall and Chaparral.
Yeah! What's the Chaparral? Chaparral.
Isn't Chaparral like
it's a plant.
I know in San Luis Obispo County, where I hail from, we have a lot of hills that have Chaparral-style wilderness. A lot of bushes.
It's tangled shrubs and thorny bushes.
Yes. But there is also a Chaparral that we call the Chaparral.
Gotcha.
Which is Larea Tridentata.
Shout outs to Larea Tridentata. Yeah. One of my favorite plants. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Past Gas. We are not a plant show. We are a car history show. My name is Nolan Sykes. Sitting across from me, as always, is Bart Bidlingmeyer.
Hi, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
And sitting to my left, Joe Weber.
Lorena Tridentata.
When you forget our last names. It's always kind of a fun curveball.
It just takes a sec for me to remember them.
Well, some people have fake names, Bart, where you go your whole life thinking that their name is
the one he remembers.
And then it's an amalgamation of two names.
I've never told you guys I had a different last name. It's that the one he gets worked
out. It's true. My RAM is low. And it takes me a sec to access
my memories.
You got
a new suspension on it, huh?
Yeah, that too. That too. I have been seeing a glut of lowered single cab pickup trucks lately.
Do they have the real wide, small wheels that are popular in LA?
No. I saw one. It was an F-150 on the 405. It looked pretty sick. It had like 24-inch wheels on it. It was slammed pretty good. The F-150s, I think, do look the best when lowered. Just because they're, especially the newer ones with the more kind of angular styling.
Yeah.
I definitely like those.
You know, I saw a Lightning the other day. Sorry, I'm kind of a little froggy right now.
You are a little froggy. That's okay, though.
I saw a Lightning parked on the street, and the opaque LED bar across the front already looks so dated.
I think like so many companies adopted that Like, you know, you see it on the Cybertruck.
I think what makes it dated is that it's opaque, though.
Oh, really?
Like, if you have, like, Audi does it well with the really bright, like, cool lights. Cool as in temperature of the light. But Blue-ish. This is, like, thick, opaque plastic. And I was like, that looks bad already.
I will say the EV Lightning does look pretty good. Like you guys said, we got a long script today. Long story, Jim Hall and Chaparral, guys, I don't really know too much about these. Besides, in Gran Turismo 4, I believe you can unlock the Chaparral 2J, which had the turbines on the back that sucked the car to the ground.
Yeah.
It was a very wedge-shaped looking car. I remember thinking, man, that's an interesting company. And now today we're going to be talking about them 20 years later. How about that?
That's crazy.
Yeah. Jim Hall was born in Abilene, Texas on July 23rd, 1935. Though his family soon moved to Colorado and also spent a decent amount of time in New Mexico, one of my favorite states, to be honest. Love New Mexico. Hall's father, Ellis, was a geologist who struck it big with Condor Petroleum, an oil and gas exploration firm. His mother had a master's degree in English from Columbia and met Jim's dad, Ellis Hall, in Guadalajara. While he was traveling for business and she was teaching English. That's like meet cute right there. The pair married in 1927 and Hall was the third of four children. Jim got a great education after the family moved to Colorado. He grew up spending his winters skiing and his summers riding horses at the family ranch. He picked up a love of aircraft from his dad, who was also an avid pilot, and was encouraged to tear apart any and all of the family's appliances to see how they worked.
So they're meth heads.
No, it's different. When they're rich, that means you're an enterprising young engineer. But when your neighbors across the street are making convertibles out of single cab pickup trucks, then yeah, they might be meth heads.
Yeah, they might be meth heads.
That's your comedy tour.
Yeah.
If you're taking apart your toaster in your kitchen, you might be a meth head.
It's me. I'm a meth head.
Jeff Foxbody over here.
Jeff Foxbody. That's good. But after World War II hit, Hall's mother, Teresa, fell ill with breast cancer, passing away in 1948. Hall's older sister, Betty, took over as the matriarch of the family, and they moved permanently to Albuquerque. It was there in Albuquerque that Jim developed the love of speed. Coming of age during the early stages of hot rodding, he still adored flying just like his father, but cars became his obsession. Living just off of Route 66, Hall admired the gorgeous pre-war cars that had been transformed into slick speed machines that passed through town. At 14 years old, he bought his first car, a Ford Model A, and earned his driver's license. When he entered high school, Hall added another all-consuming interest to his resume. Oh, this guy's got ADHD. He took up disc golf. And then bought a guitar.
Wait, is that a...
And then he started kickboxing. And then he got back into gaming.
Is anyway. That a hallmark of ADHD? That you just have a lot of hobbies?
Yeah. Yeah, because you don't stick with one thing. You, yeah.
You didn't know you have ADHD?
What?
Everyone
What'd you
here.
Say?
Oh, are you talking?
Okay, so it wasn't ADHD, but Jim did take a physics class that changed his life, and his professor recommended he take a college course on aviation weather and was advised to apply to the California Institute of Technology, aka Caltech. He did apply, and he was accepted. You gotta be smart to get in there.
To circle back, I know this is a long script, but the ADHD thing, you can think of it as being a hunter in a gatherer's world. So it's not a bad thing.
Okay. Yeah. I'm a hunter in a gatherer's world.
It's like, see? Pokemon Go.
I'm a wolf protecting the sheep. I'm a lion protecting his pride.
There's two wolves inside you, Nolan.
And they don't shut the f*** up.
Yeah. All right.
So before Jim took off for college.
There's two inside you. There are two wolves.
Yeah. One of them shits all the time.
The one that wins is the faster one.
Oh,
I didn't know you. I didn't know you hadn't heard it. I didn't know you hadn't.
I actually that saying's been made fun of so many times online that I actually didn't know that there was a second part to it. Audrey, thank you. Okay, so speaking of ADHD, Jesus Christ! Before Jim took off for college, Jim married his high school sweetheart, Nancy Fishback.
They just don't make names like this anymore, do they?
No, they don't. And spent his that's
what a shame that
that's a small town last name.
Yeah, but she lost Fishback and became Hall. Ugh.
Fishbone. What a shame.
Jim spent his summer with Nancy in Albuquerque as several members of his family, including his dad and his sister and a few of their friends, jetted off for a trip to Alaska in Ellis Hall's own plane at De Havilland Dove 2A. And unfortunately, they never returned. Imagine your whole family goes on a trip like that and just they just disappear.
I imagine it all the time.
Yeah.
Jesus. It took almost a month for the plane wreckage to be found, and it was clear that there were no survivors. Investigators assumed that the plane had come apart in midair and that there was nothing Hall could have done to save the flight. Jim was just 18 years old, heading off to California with his pregnant wife to begin an intensive study program. In his typical reserve fashion, Hall's only comment on the massive tragedy he suffered over the previous 5 years was, quote, "I got to be an adult pretty quick." Hall and his brothers, Dick and Chuck, inherited a windfall from their father. Other members of the family helped the young men sell off Condor, Ellis Hall's oil company, in order to pay the taxes and legal bills that arose during the process. They also helped the brothers establish their own smaller oil company with the funds left over. This would be a smart move. The Hall brothers were 14, 18, and 23 at the time of their dad's death, and investing their money rather than carelessly spending it set them up for the rest of their lives. It also enabled Jim Hall to fund his racing aspirations.
That'd be crazy, being 18 and be like,
running an oil company.
My family just died. I own an oil company. Yeah. I got a baby on the way.
I can't even imagine. Jim's older brother, Dick, had become interested in motorsport. In 1954, he entered an amateur race at Fort Sumner and invited his younger brother along. In an open practice session for novices, Dick handed Jim his helmet and let his brother hit the track. This would prove to be a life-changing moment. Dick's racing career eventually stalled out thanks to his arthritis, but that never stopped him from supporting his younger brother and helping encourage him to pursue a career in racing. Dick bought Jim a Ferrari 750 Monza.
That's a good older brother move.
Jesus. Technically, they were partners in the purchasing agreement, but Jim didn't actually pay for any of the car. The first time Jim Hall took the Ferrari to a race, he won.
Hell yeah. Because everything else was like a Chevy
Nova.
It's
about time to get a win, though. That's the other thing for Jim Hall. It's been a rough 5 years.
Yeah. Oh, this thing is beautiful, too. Is. Oh, my God.
How much do you think it's worth now?
He's probably worth a cool million, if I had to guess. These early Ferrari race cars. Oh, that's nice. I think I had a Hot Wheels of one of these when I was a kid. So he's racing through college, and as he prepared to graduate, it looked like he'd have it pretty good. He'd been recommended for and offered a job to join General Motors in order to work on the Corvette. So as he wrapped up his degree, Jim was figuring out how he was going to move to Detroit. But before he could, a massive recession had struck the auto industry, stopping new hires in their tracks, including Jim. Once again, Jim's older brother stepped in. Dick Hall had struck up a promising friendship with a gearhead who had just opened a shop in Dallas that effectively imported and tuned British race cars for interested buyers. It wouldn't pay well, but it would keep Jim involved in both the auto and motorsport worlds. So, Jim Hall accepted a job at a little firm called Carroll Shelby Sports Cars.
That Carroll Shelby, if you're wondering. It's not the other one.
It was that Carroll Shelby. And even if he wasn't making a ton of money, Jim Hall now had a chance to drive some of the world's best sports cars and make critical connections with other drivers, mechanics, and engineers. Jim quickly learned that the best marketing strategy was to take a car out to a race and win. When he headed back to the shop, it was almost a guaranteed that someone would be ready to buy that car. The races he competed in got bigger, with fields of internationally recognized racers like John Fitch, Olivier Gendebien, the Rodriguez brothers, and more. But unfortunately, his successes on the track weren't echoed at home. Jim and Nancy divorced, and Nancy took their three children with her to her next marriage. Meanwhile, Jim met a woman named Sandy Carroll.
Which sounds a lot like
Carroll
Shelby Carroll.
The two would marry, and she would become one of the most critical figures in Hall's later successes.
That's got to be awkward when Carroll Shelby's like, "Oh, I heard you met a nice young lady this weekend. What's her name?" Shelby Carroll.
Shelby Carroll. Sandy Carroll. But the race that launched Hill into the international scene better than any was the 1960 U.S. Formula One Grand Prix at Riverside International Raceway Hill entered with an old Lotus Climax that he'd worked on himself.
That's what you do when you see it. It's so beautiful.
Alongside drivers and better equipment. And with more experience, that got Audrey. Jim finished in seventh place, in large part only because a stub axle broke on his car. Otherwise, he would have finished within the points.
Seventh place is not in the points?
Guess not. This was a hugely impressive debut. Paired with his ongoing successes in American sports car racing and his increasing forays into serious car modification, Hall was quickly becoming a force to be reckoned with in the U.S. racing scene. I mean, talk about well-rounded.
Mm-hmm.
Good Lord. And that's why Dick Trautman and Tom Barnes reached out to Jim Hall. We got a lot of fish-themed names in this
just
episode.
Just a lot of, like, iconic names. Like, the fact that there's an 18-year-old named Jim and a 23-year-old named Dick.
Yeah.
You just don't see those nowadays.
Dick Trautman. Dick Trautman.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun to say.
Fishback.
Nancy Trautman. Fishback.
Mm-hmm.
Fish Barn.
You better not be out with that fishback girl.
She's slippery. Watch out for her.
It's just her back, Dad. The rest of her's normal.
It's actually really pretty if you look at it.
Yeah, it's like kind of has this rainbowish quality.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Trautman and Barnes were something of a dynamic motorsport duo, developing some incredible race cars that would compete at events like the Indianapolis 500. They were also two of the first people recruited by Lance Reventlow when the entrepreneur began building his Scarab sports cars. The Trautman-Barnes Scarab did fine, but the two men thought they could make it even better. Let's check out this Trautman.
Yeah, it's a good-looking car.
That car, which they called their Riverside Racer, soon became one of the first cars to carry the Chaparral name. The Trautman-Barnes offer came at a perfect time. Jim Hall had been racing a Tipo 61 Birdcage Maserati that, despite extensive modifications of his own design, was being outclassed by newer machinery.
Yeah, I mean, this Trautman, the Scarab really, from the rear, very classic European roadster, yeah. But in the front, you know, it really only has one giant opening, giant, appropriately... fish mouth,
trout-like
cooling mouth. pretty cool. Catfish-like in its ability to just suck up the air. Anyway, sorry, continue.
From that point on, I realized that I didn't want to buy last year's Lotus, Hall said. I wanted something that was better. The Scarabs were doing well, and Trautman and Barnes worked there, so I made that deal with Dick Trautman. It was the first step towards greatness.
Huh, okay.
Hall was quick enough to earn a slot on the starting grid for the 1960 U.S. Grand Prix at Riverside, starting 12th of 23 cars in an outdated Cooper Climax and finishing 7th ahead of legends like Jim Clark. He continued to make impressive statements in American sports car races to the point where he was invited to contest the entire 1963 Formula One season with the British Racing Partnership. Behind the wheel of an outdated Lotus 24, which is a sick car that looks like a go-kart, and with a team that was about to fold for good, Hall managed to secure 2 points paying finishes that year, good enough for 13th overall in the World Drivers Championship.
Okay.
According to Hall in his biography, Texas Legend, he hadn't realized he was inking a deal with a team that was, for all intents and purposes, dying. He had already established his own race team, Chaparral Cars, and was building and testing his own cars at Rattlesnake Raceway in Midland, Texas. But when you get an opportunity to head overseas in Formula One, you take it. Back in America, Hall continued competing in cars of his own design in the Canadian American Challenge Cup Series, which was a sports car racing series intended to showcase the craziest innovations in racing technology. We know that as Can-Am.
Mm.
Of the 14 races he started, Hall finished second in 5 of them and 3rd once. But his real focus was on the innovative work he was doing inside of his race shop. After Hall's 1968 crash at Stardust, his racing days were over. The force of the impact had twisted his legs into his lap, pulverizing the bones in his knees.
Oh my God.
Medical science had no real way to repair them, leaving Hall with a limp for the rest of his life. Honestly, like, a limp is the best case scenario in that situation.
I mean, it's lucky his freaking leg wasn't, like, torn off.
Yeah. His leg was in his lap.
This guy's been through a lot. During his time running the Troutman Barnes Chaparral 1, Jim Hall had ended up making so many modifications that the car was no longer the one he bought, but an entirely different and far more aerodynamic machine. According to Hall, Troutman and Barnes knew how to make a beautiful car, but that beauty wasn't built on an engineering foundation. In 1960, it's kind of like the philosophy of, like, in those early days before CFD and, like, true aerodynamic science, you kind of, like, had a rough idea of what would work.
Yeah.
And, like, the more beautiful it was, like, it just happens that swoopy, nice
the
lines
air just
and curves.
Caresses it.
Yeah. But they had no way to, like, prove it.
Well, I think wedge cars are a good example of this, where it's like they're not very aerodynamic. Like, no. They cut through the air, but then they create so much
a lot of drag
vortex behind it.
In 1962, Hall toyed with the idea of moving out to his own little crop of land and managed to convince fellow racers Hap Sharp and Ronnie Hissom to add him to an investment group that scooped up some land in Midland, Texas. Sharp and Hall built their garages across from one another, and they became fast friends, using their shared
race.
Fast friends. Check out our new podcast, Fast Friends.
Using their shared land to start working on their cars together. Before long, they decided they'd build their own car, the car that became known as the Chaparral 2. The engineer crew Hall had out in Midland was small, consisting of only about 20 folks. Many of them didn't have experience in motorsport, instead coming in from boat racing or aviation. Admittedly, that worked even better because it meant that everybody was thinking outside the box and that each car was more impressive than the last. Yeah, I mean, if you're coming out from outside industries, you're not like necessarily tied down by, quote, conventional knowledge, right? You're not coming at it like, for example, that's why I think like Linus Tech Tips and Marques Brownlee do pretty good car reviews because they're not looking at it from like a really ethereal and like, concerned with legacy, kind of like they're not coming at it from a fanboy perspective when it comes to cars, right? Like they're looking at it as product reviews, and I think that's why they do a good job.
I don't like his review on the EV, the Dodge EV. I
haven't watched that one yet.
I mean, they're all EVs that
he mostly reviews. Focuses on EVs. Yeah,
autofocus.
Yes,
on EVs.
But that's why I think they do a great job, because they're not like they don't have a bunch of preconceived notions about the brands that they're covering. They're just looking at it from
it's so sterile. Like, sorry to lay into Marques. He does really cool tech reviews. I just am not a huge fan of the car reviews because he comes at it like a smartphone. And it's like,
that's why I like it, though, I guess. That's why I think they're good. There's a tendency, I think, in car reviews. I mean, I struggle with it a lot when we do new car reviews.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, that instinct that a lot of people have to like prove that they know about cars.
Oh, God.
You know? And it's a hard thing to get past.
It's like this gatekeepy sarcasm where it's like,
well, that too. That's just kind of hacky.
Yeah, hacky.
It's hard to get past too. I mean, yeah, I'm certainly guilty of that as well. Anyway,
have you ever seen Friendly Geordie's review of his like Daewoo? But he's like, this Porsche 911 is the peak.
The Chaparral 2 pulled some serious inspiration from the aviation world, thanks to its semi-monocoque fiberglass chassis. There were a few integral design elements that Hall knew he wanted to include in his new car after his experience with the Chaparral 1, and the primary element was a stiff chassis. To do something that no other racing car manufacturer had thought to do, Hall needed to look beyond the automotive world, and he looked right to the semi-monocoque chassis being built in aviation.
I mean, if you take a look at the Chaparral 2, it looks like a shark was like turned into a car. It's got gills. It's got a snorkel on the hood.
Oh, yeah. This thing's crazy
looking. Yeah. It's got huge pipes sticking out the rear engine.
Yeah, those big headers. Wow. That is crazy as hell.
Yeah. Wow, you're crazy as hell. Rattlesnake Raceway.
Other automakers had begun experimenting with that chassis style, but the Chaparral crew also turned to the boating world for inspiration with composite body structures. He turned to General Motors for inspiration in the aerodynamic shape of the car, and before long, he'd built something incredible. The V-shaped lip spoiler kept the car on the ground, while the mid-engine construction kept for an even weight distribution. The car also introduced the automatic transmission to racing, which totally eliminated the use of the clutch pedal. Why? Well, as Roger Penske liked to say, quote,
I've heard Hall say that the big advantage of the automatic transmission is that it lets the chaparral driver use his free hand to wave at the other drivers as he passes them.
Of the 22 races the car entered, it won 16 of them.
Damn.
Yikes.
That's that's domination right there.
I think it's pretty cool looking at the car to think about this is early 60s.
Yeah.
It's its own.
That's cooler than hell. That's cooler than hell, man. And man, that's cooler than, hey, you Pikachu, man.
That car right there? That's cooler than Pokemon Stadium.
The next evolution was the 2C, which had a brief four-event lifespan, but it was critical because it featured not only a wing, but a wing that the driver could operate from the cockpit, as well as a three-speed torque converter, an aluminum chassis, and advanced suspension geometry that kept the car incredibly stable. The 2C didn't last long, but it set the tone for what they do next, developing the 2D and 2E in tandem. The 2D would be used in the 1966 International World Sports Car Championship, while the 2E would stick it out in America in the Canadian American Challenge Cup, better known as Can-Am. Hell yeah, brother. So, there, the innovations on the 2C were much more sophisticated, sparked by Hall's realization that net downforce, or the total amount of downward aerodynamic pressure exerted by a vehicle, was the, quote, next great frontier in vehicle performance. The 2D featured an enclosed cockpit, a small rear wing, and a tunnel underneath the nose, ooh, all designed to keep the car on the ground.
Primitive ground effect, if you baby.
This is one where the wing is almost comical.
Oh, it's it looks like
if you did it yourself in your garage almost. But it's about, like, what, 4 feet above the car?
Yeah.
In the clean air.
Yeah, the Can-Am car has that giant wing, as Bart mentioned. But the 2D, this was also in a Gran Turismo game. I remember this car quite well. This thing's sick, man.
This one looks like a Ford GT.
Yes, 40. Like you said, very, it's an enclosed cockpit. Pretty strange looking, though.
Sarah had that Miata that she'd race.
Lemons
Miata. Yeah.
And I asked her once, I was like, how much downforce do you think that thing gives you? She goes, I think it's supposed to be like 50 pounds. And I was just like, does it weigh 50 pounds? I don't know how it's going to do that. But
I bet it does way more. Because that sure. It was like balsa wood or something, plywood or something.
Yeah,
and it was angled pretty. It looked steep.
It's comical and f-ing awesome.
Yeah,
and
so sick.
The 2E was a watershed. The 2C had shown that a rear wing could work, but the first version wasn't perfect because the 2C's wing was mounted to the bodywork. Hall found that the whole car would bottom out at the back when he enacted extra downforce, while the front end would lift up. It'd get light on the front end. On the 2E though, the wing was mounted to the rear wheel hubs, pushing all that downforce directly onto the wheels and keeping the car more balanced.
That's awesome.
Crazy.
The wing, mounted 3 feet above the body of the car in order to better manage lift, added downforce that was equaled by a throttle valve in the front of the car that helped equal out the downforce pressure. And by adding radiators to the side of the car, Hall created a better center of gravity and also avoided creating an ultra-hot footwell that sapped strength from the drivers during races as their feet slowly cooked in the car. You don't want to sous vide your feet, folks.
That's what I got for lunch, though.
You got the sous vide foot?
Yeah. Mm. Fall off the bone.
I'd eat anything sous vide. I tell you that much right now. That's something I learned at color school.
The 2F improved on the 2E in one important way. It added a front downforce modulation device in the form of a spring-loaded door inside an airspeed pressurized chamber behind the front air inlet.
What the hell?
Increased speed and max downforce configuration, and the air pressure partially opens the door, reducing front downforce.
That's awesome.
The driver could also fully open the door on corners, paired with the rotation of the wing. It was just absurdly balanced. The 2G was essentially a version of the 2E with wider tires. But then, there was a little car called the 2J.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now, back to the show.
In the mid-1960s, Chaparral had developed a tight but secretive relationship with Chevrolet. General Motors was firm in its stance that it was not going to compete directly in motorsport, but there was just one big problem called the Chevy Corvair. If you've heard of the Corvair, it's probably because you've heard it's a dangerous, out-of-control car that killed a bunch of people. a sentiment that got blown a little out of proportion thanks to Ralph Nader's book, Unsafe at Any Speed.
Nader!
The Corvair was the first mass-produced rear-engine car on the American market. And while it did have a few issues, one enterprising lawyer named David Harney decided he could capitalize it on this after a few Corvair drivers got hurt behind the wheel.
Harney Davidson.
I'm of the opinion that if a company willingly and knowingly puts out a dangerous product, that they should be punished for that.
Well, anyone can crash any car, though.
That's true, but they also had the car would have been safe had the tires been filled to GM's specified parameters, and then the dealers just didn't tell people, and then so it just became this whole snowballing thing.
Harney alleged that the problem with the Corvair was due to its very construction, meaning that GM had designed, built, and then sold a car it knew from the start that was dangerous. There was no single faulty part, but an inherent fault in the Corvair's vehicle dynamics. Hundreds of lawsuits began to pile up, and GM realized it had to do something. Rather than settle out of court, it decided to challenge these allegations in front of a judge and jury. But to do that, it needed to amass a ton of data about how the Corvair and its competitors handled. It couldn't do that at its Michigan testing grounds, not unless they wanted reporters and lawyers tooling around. Plus, they needed to hire some experts in vehicle dynamics to do the testing. I'm sure you can see where this is going. General
so
Motors
hired Rodney Dangerfield.
Close.
Can't get any respect.
Close. GM hired Jim Hall.
Ah,
that is very close, though.
One of the big reasons why Hall could experiment with his cars was because GM paid him a lot of money to test them at his Chaparral shop and his test track, Rattlesnake Raceway. It also provided Chaparral with a ton of equipment to track data and an open line to Chevrolet's research and development department. Thanks to Hall's findings, as well as testimony from F1 legends like Juan Manuel Fangio and Stirling Moss, Chevy was cleared of all wrongdoing in the Corvair cases.
Oh, thank God.
Wow.
Eat the charges.
I had no idea Fangio was involved with that. It's crazy.
Yeah, kind of random, huh?
The line to Chevy also helped Chaparral get the 2J off the ground. In 1968, Hall initially pitched the concept of a car that creates downforce by sucking air out from beneath it, meaning you didn't even have to be moving to achieve downforce.
That's crazy.
Which was otherwise achieved when you were at high speed. Chevy made a rough mock-up of the idea to test it and found that Hall's idea worked. And then they started building a prototype. They slapped some small engines on the back of a car to power two fans that would suck air out from the underside of the machine, and then thought about how they'd seal off the bottom. With the Corvair lawsuit solved and GM leadership in chaos, racing was once again treated with disdain within the company. Anything that even resembled a race car needed to be destroyed.
Boo!
But the guys at Chevy R&D managed to save the bits and pieces of the vacuum car, which it shipped off to Hall.
Use that in my living room, cleaning up after the kids.
At that point, it was just a tub with some body pieces. No engine or no wiring. The fans hadn't even been installed. But this prototype would become the basis for the Chaparral 2J. And the 20-man crew down in Midland set out to work, bringing it up to racing condition.
But not before enjoying a nice burrito down the street.
Mmm.
With a glass of chocolate milk.
Ew.
Oh my God.
That's the Midland way, guys.
I mean, barf.
We do things a little different around here. Chocolate milk margarita?
I'll tell you what.
Tajin rim?
Ooh. Jim was recovering from serious injuries he sustained in a racing crash. And he was also trying to satisfy Chevy by fielding its new Camaros in Trans Am. But Hall was determined to pursue this idea, to find out what would happen if you could create downforce not by managing airflow, but by generating your own low-pressure area. I've tried to generate my own low-pressure area, but it's just not working.
You got a little essential oil diffuser.
Yeah. Get the music kitties going, tried, little chimes.
Tried,
yeah.
I did. I've tried meditating. It's interesting.
Cool.
Yeah.
Did you do it?
Yeah. I've been doing it.
You were able to silence your mind?
No.
It's hard.
It's really
You
really
have to
difficult.
Practice.
Yeah, you do. So, anyway, this low-pressure area generation was the introduction of ground effect. The benefits were huge. First and foremost, a vacuum would mean Chaparral wouldn't have to worry much about generating downforce via wings or other appendages stuck onto the car. Appendages that generated a lot of drag.
Secondly, a giant fan could generate downforce regardless of how fast the car was going. With the parts GM dropped off, Chaparral set to work. They'd need to expand the suction zone from the center of the car to the front and the rear. They'd also need to move the fans, adapted from a military tank engine, to the rear of the car, and find a way to power them, perhaps with some go-kart engines. A suction zone, that's funny. The bottom of the chassis was lined with Lexan plastic skirts that sealed to the ground when the fans were in action.
No one's got that sign above his bed.
Suction zone.
Yeah.
Fans welcome.
Yeah. There are a lot of unlucky problems with this car, though. During a test, a radiator hose blew off and filled the cockpit with boiling water. Hall, still recovering from a different accident, was unable to pull himself quickly from his seat filling with the boiling water, and as a result, the skin on his butt boiled right off.
Unbelievable.
It took weeks for Hall to heal.
That's worse than the McDonald's coffee.
Yeah. Longweets, where no one was allowed in the room, lest they bring with them an infection. Dude,
God damn.
I can't think of, like, a, for me personally, a worse place to lose skin. I love sitting on my ass.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I need that skin.
It's not what's on your butt. It's what's close to your butt that I'm worried about. There's also meat there that can be boiled right off.
Yeah. So, not good, dude. Then GM delivered those Camaros late, which meant Chaparral got a late start preparing it.
Yeah, I think I'd still be worried about the meat being boiled off my butt. I don't care about these goddamn Camaros.
A young, promising mechanic was killed making a parts run for the team, and during a test run, a driver crashed the 2H beyond repair. Plus, the 2J was still of questionable legality. See, nothing in the international rulebook by which Can-Am operated, Appendix J, outright banned ground effect. It did ban suspension-mounted wings and aerodynamic devices after some nasty accidents took place in Formula One resulting from those components. To find out for sure if this would work, Hall called up the SCCA, a famously chill organization.
Yeah.
Quote, "It was obvious at this point that the 2J had huge potential, so when I started thinking about turning it into a race car, I talked to the SCCA technical people about it to make sure we weren't wasting our time," Hall said. "When I got an approval from them, that's when I was fully on board with developing the car into a raceable state for the upcoming Can-Am season." Good for him. When the 2J hit the track, well after the start of this 1970 Can-Am season, it was a little bit of a disaster. Drivers like Jackie Stewart and Vic Elford praised its handling, going so far as to say there was so much downforce that it actually felt a little boring to drive since you weren't wrestling the car to keep it in contact with the pavement. But the car pulled in dirt, and the auxiliary engines were prone to overheating. The 2J rarely finished a race, and it was slow off the starting line, but when it moved, it went fast. The competition, though, was not impressed. Personnel from McLaren and Lola, the top competitors in Can-Am at the time, called a meeting with the series leaders to demand the 2J be banned. The SCCA initially approved the technology, but ultimately the FIA had final say. The FIA, another famously chill organization, banned the car. The FIA's ruling read, quote, "Ground effect systems in auto racing applications do not comply to International Sporting Commission rules. Appendix J clearly specifies that any specific part of the car which has an aerodynamic influence on the stability of the vehicle must compulsorily be fitted on the entire sprung part of the car and be firmly fixed while the car is in motion. Consequently, the device such as currently conceived cannot be considered as complying with Appendix J owing to the presence of mobile parts, propellers and plastic curtains ensuring contact with the ground," unquote.
Wow, just say you don't like my car.
That hurt, guys.
Ouch.
And that
hurt more than when the skin was boiled off my butt.
This dude's been through a lot.
Yeah.
And that was it. The 2J, which Chaparral had been hoping to field with much better results in 1971, was dead.
With the Chaparral 2J banned before it ever really got a chance to race, Jim Hall quit racing for good. "I completely lost interest in racing. I devoted a lot of my time and my effort to this, and I wound up in a blind alley." Looking back on the decision that he helped spearhead, McLaren driver Denny Hulme admitted that banning the 2J, quote, "was the most stupid thing we'd ever did, and it was the first major step we took toward killing off the greatest road racing series ever conceived."
That was horrible. So good.
That was so bad, dude. Robin Hurd of the March racing team told Road and Track in early 71 that Hall's departure from the sport, quote, undermined the series enormously. It was still a very credible series, but he and General Motors added so much to it. It was never really the same. By 75, Can-Am was dead. As the years passed, so too did many of Hall's general frustrations with motorsport. In 1974, when Lola importer Carl Haas reached out to Jim Hall about going open wheel racing. By that point, everyone wanted to be associated with what Hall and Haas were cooking up. They were able to go full-time in 1978, winning the series Triple Crown of the Indy 500, the Pocono 500, and the California 500.
Huh.
But a handful of problems had popped up in those big events that Hall was determined to fix. Inspired by Formula One's ground effect Lotus 78, Hall sketched a rough outline of a new car he'd called the Chaparral 2K, which he then commissioned designer John Barnard to bring to life. Like the Lotus 78, the 2K integrated ground effect. The underside of the car contained two long tunnels. As air entered at the front, it created a low-pressure zone under the car, which would then pull it to the ground.
This thing is very similar to the Lotus 79.
The side skirts are very long. They go almost to the ground.
Very cool car, though. Looks sweet.
Transmission trouble kept this ultra-dominant car from winning the 1979 Indy 500, but the following year, Johnny Rutherford took a victory from pole position, leading the most laps in the process. A win in the CART IndyCar World Series Championship was icing on the cake that year.
Nice. Okay.
Nice. Now we're getting into CART. Okay. We talked about CART and IndyCar, the difference between the two.
The split. We talked about that a while ago. But that's a great episode. But wow. Winning the Indy 500 is very cool.
That's massive. Massive, mate. Did you do an English accent too?
Yeah, it was like, massive.
Massive.
Proper chuffed.
Hall stuck around in IndyCar for a while, but he ultimately realized it was time to call it quits. After the 1981 season, he retired yet again, this time of his own accord. This is like Jeremy Clarkson saying he's going to come back and host another car show.
Just like it, dude. At 89 years of age, Jim Hall is still alive and kicking.
Well, not kicking, because that bone leg.
With his life's work immortalized in Midland, Texas's Permian Basin Petroleum Museum. There, every month, a handful of dedicated engineers will take one of Hall's Chaparrals out for a quick drive around the parking lot. And if you want, you can join a group of dedicated Chaparral fans for a dinner, an exhibition run, and a Q&A with Jim Hall himself during his annual party on the patio, baby. Yes.
$100 that dinner is steak.
I'll take a Texas steak right now. Yeah. Reflecting on his life and his biography, Texas Legend, Jim Hall says, quote, I didn't set out to change racing. I was just trying to build winning race cars. I lived in a time where a few people working their hearts out could accomplish something that was significant in their chosen field. I'll leave it to others to decide how important our group out in Midland was. I will say, Jim, pretty important. These are some really amazing cars that you and your team built. And we'd say it was pretty damn significant.
Like, led to so many innovations. And look at the cars nowadays. They have side pods. They have...
He was ahead of the game.
Yeah. If you look at the wings on the earlier cars, they're definitely, like, aviation-inspired.
Yeah.
They have, like, the teardrop shape. I think they've become more nuanced.
It was just a wing flipped.
Yeah.
Well said. All right. So that was Jim Hall's story, the story of Chaparral as well. A lot of really cool cars that you guys got to go on Google now, honestly.
Go on Google.
Make sure you check out that, was it the 2E? I like the 2E a lot.
2E is cool. 2J is the most iconic, I mean, that's the fan car.
Yeah. But dude, don't sleep on that 2F. These are all amazing. And the 2K, of course.
All iconic in their own right.
Yeah. I'm just glad we told the story.
Yeah. Super cool. I'd love to meet this guy one day.
Well, we got to head out to one of those parties on the patio, Joe. This was a pretty long episode, so no listener mail this week. But if you'd like us to read some mail, hit us up at passgas@donutmedia.com. Big thank you to our writer this week, Elizabeth Blackstock, always crushing it. Go listen to Liz's podcast as well, Deadly Passions, Terrible Joys. That's also a racing history podcast, and Liz just crushes it every time. She's just so smart. So good. So thank you, Liz, for writing this episode. Listen to our news podcast, Big Three, For your weekly automotive news, follow the boys at Bits Bardo, at Joji Weber, and me at Nolan J. Sykes if you'd like. Big thank you to our crew. As always, you got Edgar Grajeda right there behind the camera, right behind you, and Audrey Holden behind the mixing board. This was a really good one. Jim Hall, what an inspiration. See you guys next time.
Bye.
Bye-bye.